The committee will come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting. It is Tuesday, January 7th, approximately 3:30 in the afternoon. All members are present, so we do have a quorum. I'd like the committee members to first put their attention on to Senate Bill 189. At our last hearing, we had a motion to adopt the backslash L version as the working document before us. Held it over just to see if there were any concerns of committee members, and if not, I'd like to have the committee consider final action on the bill today. We do have Mr. Dwayne Bannock is online to answer questions, or the really, really difficult questions. We have Deb Grumman here to answer the questions from Senator Huggins' office. We also, I don't think we had much discussion last week on the fiscal note, and of course there is a $20,000 one-time cost reported on the fiscal note, and the bill will advance up to finance after this committee action. So at this point, do committee members have any questions for Mr. Bannock or for myself or Senator Huggins? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Senator Wagner?
I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 189 backslash L with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to the motion?
I object just for the purpose of
Senator Elton?
I appreciate what we heard from the sponsor. I appreciate what we heard from the director of the Division of Motor Vehicles, and I don't have any real problem with what I see in front of me. I think the issue that I'm going to be thinking about as this bill progresses through the process is the umbrella issue of the real ID kind of approach that the federal government has, and what the responsibility of the state might be as we try to accede to the requests of the federal government. It's just it's a philosophical issue with me, and so I'm going to be a no rec as I ponder that issue. And I'm saying this so that the sponsor staff or people from the Division of Motor Vehicles that might want to assuage some of the concerns that I have, they can talk to me as the bill continues through. So just wanted to put that on the record, and with that, Mr. Chair, I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Seeing no objection, then the Senate State Affairs Committee CS will move from committee to next committee of referral. Okay, that brings us then to the other item on our agenda for today. It's the confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee Scott Nordstrand. And Mr. Nordstrand is here. And we do have information with Mr. Nordstrand's resume. But Scott, if you want to, certainly we all know you, know who you are, but for the record, if you just want to put yourself on the record and sort of give us the rundown of your interest in the position and your qualifications.
Thank you, Chair Terrio. My name is Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Administration. It's a great honor to be here today. It's a great honor to have the support of Governor Murkowski for this very important appointment. Arguably, the department is the most diverse in state government. I want to say a special, and in the last 3 months, I've been immersed in understanding that diversity. And to that end, my two deputies, Kevin Brooks and Mike Tibbles, have been essential. And I think you all know them and know the quality of the work that they provide, and I want to thank them for their assistance. I'd like to cover three areas briefly and then respond to your questions. First, a bit of background about me. Next, a few words on how my expertise will help me be an effective commissioner of administration, in my estimation. And finally, an overview of the principal challenges that I believe face the department in the next year. I visited with all of you. Some of this will be old hat because we've talked about it already, but we'll go over it briefly. First of all, I was raised in a small Wisconsin town on the St. Croix River. I went to undergraduate school at the University of Wisconsin at River Falls. I got a degree in political science and history in 1984, and of course that qualified me for virtually nothing except going to law school, which I proceeded to do the next year at the University of North Dakota at Grand Forks. In 1987, I graduated there, but while in law school in North Dakota, I decided my first year of clerking that I could afford to go to someplace exotic to be a clerk. And so I applied and got out Martindale Hubble, which to lawyers is a directory of all the lawyers in the known universe. And I got out the directory and I applied to Guam, U.S. Virgin Islands, Hawaii, Samoa, Alaska, and a whole bunch of different interesting places. And lo and behold, in sitting in my little apartment in, on Highway 2 in Grand Forks, I got a call from an attorney named Mike Garrity at the firm of Scheibel, Staley, Delisio, and Garrity then. And Mike interviewed me on the phone for a few minutes and offered me a job as a clerk, got a plane ticket, and I showed up in Alaska in 1985 in the summer. Inertia being what it is, I also came in 1986. And again, inertia being what it is, when I graduated from law school in 1987, I was offered a position at that firm in Anchorage and took it. Ultimately, after I passed the bar, I chose to switch to a different law firm, Owens and Turner, another firm in Anchorage, Alaska. I spent the next 15 years at Owens and Turner. Again, inertia is a pretty big thing for me. I think 15 years in one law firm is a long time, I think, or any job. But I rose to become a partner in the firm. I practiced in basically employment and commercial litigation. One of my partners was an employment and labor lawyer, and one of my other partners was a commercial transaction lawyer and litigator, and so I sort of did the litigation for both sides of the house. You can see from my resume, I did spend some time before the Supreme Court. I have 10 reported decisions there on various topics, a wide array of areas, because the firm was small and necessarily had a lot of different areas to cover. But again, all civil work. In 2003, after the election in 2002, I thought maybe time for a change. There was an opportunity here, I thought, to go to work for the new Republican administration. And so I literally got the P.O. box address with Jim Clark's name on it and sent in my packet of resume. And somehow or another, it wound its way to Greg Rankus. I had applied to become the Deputy Attorney General or alternatively the office chief for Anchorage. He interviewed me twice in Anchorage. I'd never met him before in my life. To my surprise and happiness, he chose me to become his deputy attorney general for the civil division. I did that for about 3 years or so. And just to give a little background, the civil division, you may know, runs all of the civil legal matters for the state of Alaska. There are about 140 lawyers working there. 250 total employees, something like that, and in FY06 a budget of about $43 million. For a brief time, I had the opportunity to serve as the acting attorney general for 2 months after General Rankus left. And then when Ray Matuszewski decided to move on, I looked at the Department of Administration and thought, this is something that I think I can do. And let me give you a sense. So that's the background. Now, why is it that I think my qualifications fit the Department of Administration? First of all, I would be the first attorney commissioner of the Department of Administration. And I don't know that for sure, but I believe it is. I haven't had anybody tell me to the contrary yet. And I think that says a lot and can offer a lot of help to the attorneys in the department. Of all the branches of, or the departments in state government, there are more attorneys in the Department of Administration than anywhere except the Department of Law. And in fact, there probably shouldn't be attorneys pretty much anywhere else. At least the Department of Law wouldn't appreciate that. So you look, the Office of Public Advocacy, the Public Defender Agency, the new Office of Administrative Hearings run by Terry Thurbin, and the Labor Relations Division also does essentially legal work on grievances and collective bargaining agreements. So I think my attorney background offers me a special perspective, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of my ideas in that regard in a minute. I also was an employment lawyer, and I think that helps me in some of the things that the department does as well. The Division of Personnel is there, the Division of Labor Relations, and Retirement and Benefits. These are all areas where at least I have some passing acquaintance with the law involved in my prior life as a civil lawyer. I was a commercial and tort lawyer, and I think the General Services Division, which does procurement and leasing and contracts, I have some background there that's useful. The Division of Finance as well, and Risk Management is basically the insurance company for the state of Alaska, involving the tort claims, workers' compensation claims, and general liability claims for the state. again, a lawyer's perspective offers some help there. Of all that, though, I think the thing that prepared me the most that I would offer is my time as Deputy Attorney General for the state of Alaska. It's a wonderful job. I mean, the prior Deputy Attorney General, Barb Ritchie, once told me it's the best job in the world. And she may very well be right, and, you know, who knows, maybe someday I'll regret this choice. But it was a wonderful time. It allowed me to manage a significant chunk of the state government. It allowed me to learn how to manage people. I didn't really have that kind of a skill in my prior life in an 8-person law firm. I think I learned. Again, I understood the state process, state budgeting, this process that we go through, and I think that assists me in understanding how the Department of Administration works. And I also worked, as I think most of you know, on a lot of different legislative issues and worked with a lot of legislatures, and I think we developed a good relationship. So that's the background that I think demonstrates some experience that will be useful as commissioner. We've all talked a little bit about the meeting that I had with my division directors in early December. It was a retreat out at the Grace Scheibel House at the university. And we did a lot of things. We talked about a lot of issues. In fact, for a lot of the 15 directors in the Department of Administration, the first time, some of them had never met each other before. And so it was interesting to bring them all together and to talk about the divergent things that they do, everything from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board to the Division of Finance to Enterprise Technology. I mean, it's all over the map. And what we did was we came up with a list. I call it Big Things for 2006. This is essentially our department's to-do list. And it's designed to be something outside the norm, not the normal get the payroll out, process that grievance, respond to that telephone request, issue that driver's license. This is to be out of the ordinary things to move the boat, so to speak, and so that at the end of the year, and if it's only a year, so be it, that we can look back and say we actually accomplished some things for the state. Brief overview, and then you can just ask questions about which ones of these might interest you. Point one, we need to invest in technology. The state of Alaska is behind in where it should be in some of its technology. Number one primary problem is the phone system, and we've talked about this, but our Nortel-based phone system is 12 or 13 years old. It's run on a private or PBX network that we maintain, Exchange in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. Its software and its switches, its components are too old, and they need to be either upgraded at great expense or converted to another kind of phone system. In fact, there are 15,000 phones or so in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks on the 451, 465, 269 exchanges that state employees operate. Some 700 of them now are already voice over internet protocol phones or Cisco phones. We have shown that this technology, which was once cutting edge, is now mainstream, I think, and deployable in a reasonable, sustainable, reliable way. And so we need to go forward with that technology rather than, in my estimation, paying backward to legacy technology. Now, it's a balancing act because you don't want the thing to fall down while you're trying to move forward, and we're going to have to be cognizant of that. But you'll see in our budget request a capital item, and I think even in the supplemental, some money to go forward with VoIP phones as soon as possible and to go find the buildings where it's wired and ready to go and change out the phones. For example, the Atwood building in Anchorage is, we believe, one of those kinds of buildings. Another big thing we're doing is we're doing a conversion top to bottom with Microsoft for all the state computers in the executive branch. So we're not going to have to go buy software and the end with year-end money and hope you got enough money to buy Office 2003 for enough people in your department or your division. We're going to have a software assurance program where we pay a set fee that we've already paid for our 15,000 or so seats, and then we are going to have current Microsoft software from network operating system all the way out to the desktop permanently for a fee, annual fee. And that's very good, but it's a great challenge because we have different departments with different kinds of software. Some are Novell, some are Unix. Many are Microsoft, but most don't have Outlook, for example, the email program that we will be using. We have an Oracle-based system. That's going to be a big project. We think we can do it in the next year or slightly more. We're moving Alaska Land Mobile Radio System back from DMVA to Department of Administration because it's going to soon be built out and ready to go. People are using it. The Department of Defense is using it. DOT is using it. Now it's time to bill for it. And that's one of the things the Department of Administration, as I'm sure some, does anybody here from the departments knows, the Department of Administration sends out bills for the services we provide, and that's one of the kinds of things we'll do there. We need to stabilize the Alaska Public Office's computer system so that when we get to the next election and thousands of people start querying those servers and saying, you know, who gave what to whom, that the thing doesn't break. It has in the past. It's not acceptable going forward. And we're going to use some of the resources of the Department of Administration, specifically our enterprise technology people, to help stabilize that and make that work and be solid. That's technology. Now, what one other area I think we need to look at is how we support our state employees. One very big thing we're working on is a new contract for a third-party administrator for our health care plan. Aetna is now the contractor. That's up. It's time to bid it again and see who has got the best proposal, and we're in the middle of that process. We're rolling out the new Tier 4 retirement program, and as plan administrator, it's my job and our staff's job and the Division of Retirement Benefits to make that a success, for people to understand it, people to understand if they want to convert to it, if they're not vested in the present Tier 3. And we are in the process of procuring a record keeper, an educator, and financial advisor to help people understand that program and to make it a success. The State Travel Office is another thing that's much maligned, but I think in the long term it's going to be a great success, and I think, frankly, it already has been a success. We got a deal with Alaska Airlines for cheaper airfare on full fare coach seats, Y-class seats. And we found out that 44% of all state travel in the executive branch, 44% is a Y-class seat. That sounds terrible. But the reality is the great majority of that is Medicaid travel. In fact, half of all executive branch travel is for Medicaid, for health care services. And often those are not predictable kinds of plane tickets. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't try to do better than 44%. But honestly, when we looked at how we could save the most money in the best way and what we could do with Alaska Airlines, they said, we'll sell you a Y-class fare for the next fare down. And between various city pairs, that's widely ranging different kind of a discount. But the bottom line is, in the first year of operation of the STO, when we had Medicaid in for the whole year, and we didn't have departments in for a whole year, Medicaid saved $766,000 in airfare on Alaska Airlines alone, just that one. And we're doing a lot of other things we can talk about if you'd like, get cheaper hotels, cheaper car rentals, and even looking at a cheaper hotel rate on a national basis. In other words, a chain outside, a Marriott, a Hilton chain. Will you give us a deal if we steer people to you? Let's see. Deferred maintenance on the state office building. And I've got something I want to show you. I have a prop. The state office buildings, and in particular the state office building, or SOB, was built with galvanized steel pipes. And after 20 or 30 years, galvanized steel pipes rust. This is a water pipe that was cross-sectioned out, and you can see the rust inside that. I'm going to pass it around. It's kind of amazing. You can even see that the pipe itself is coming through. I mean, the rust is coming through the pipe itself. One of the projects that's been completed by during this administration is the rejuvenation of the SOB for purposes of replacing the pipes. And there's a lot of projects like that. Lots of projects, and the SOB in particular, I mean, there's asbestos over there. There's lots of challenges that we need to take on. And one of the most amazing things I found out is that for every state office building we have, and there are state office buildings in the public building fund, and there are some that aren't, but for every one we've got, we have a punch list. We have a punch list for every building that says what's wrong in every building, when we're going to fix it, if we are, when we get money. We literally go down the list and triage this stuff so we can figure out what's the best way to spend the money. So you send us as much money as you can to do that with the governor's blessing, And then we go down the list and try to fix things like this. So, I mean, that's a very important thing, I think, for quality of life for our employees. And I guess I'd leave it with that. I'll leave you with one last story, though. When I first came to the job, I parked down on P2 in the SOB, and I used to walk every day through there and go to my office, you know, when I would be down here in Juneau to my office in the Diamond Courthouse. I never really paid much attention just to the atrium itself. It's a wonderful space. I mean, it's probably one of the best spaces in Juneau, if not Alaska, in terms of public buildings. And I started walking through there, and I see all these old ratty office chairs just laying up against the wall, and, you know, you wonder, what is that about? And the dumpsters, the trash dumpsters, they're parked in the middle of the, you know, not in the middle, but, I mean, over the sites, you see these big dumpsters of trash, you know. I said, why is this? And basically, I think there was a lack of, they were working on the big things. I think there was a lack of attention to the little things that I think make employees appreciate where they are and the building they're in a little bit more in their job. And so one of the things we're doing, and we're committed to do it before the end of the legislative session, this is like a 3-month project, to spruce up the atrium, to make it more user-friendly, put in some tables for people to sit on. So there are people in there, they have lunch by sitting on the radiators, because they use the bench for their table. It's kind of crazy. So one of the things we want to do is to make a better place for employees, because, you know, we do have recruitment and retention problems in state government and a lot of different spots. But money isn't everything. Part of it is, do you enjoy the place you're going to work and the people you're working with, and are you appreciated? And so I'll leave it with that, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Scott, I couldn't help but notice on that piece of pipe that it appeared you'd tried to do repair on it. It was a piece of duct tape on it.
You know, I don't know the history of the duct tape. I'd have to ask my. But you know, the interesting thing, and I don't know if I should say this, but the person who keeps custody of the pipe is the state risk manager. One would hope it would be our general services people, but it's the risk manager who's managing risk, and I hope there was no risk associated with this. But let's just say they're all drinking good water now. So,
you know, maybe one of the more famous parts about where I come from is where they proclaim the duct tape capital of Alaska, maybe of the U.S. And my wife, you know, gave me a duct tape checkbook cover. I don't think it works very good on pipes, though, to be quite frank. But you're not going to unseat us by taping all your pipes up in part
of
the
No, we've got new pipes now, and it's going well. We've also completed the elevator renovations. And anybody who ever had to deal with those elevators that were in the parking garage, and whether or not they work or not, you know, and once upon a time, most of you know, I was about 200 pounds heavier. And I can tell you that going up those 8 flights of stairs was a little bit of a challenge a couple of years ago, and I'm glad to see we have new elevators, though now I think I probably could do the stairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd just like to say that you know, Scott came around and talked to most of us here within the last couple of weeks, and you know, there's not many motherhood and apple pie sorts of things in department administration, but I was impressed by the fact that, I mean, you did your homework and the degree of enthusiasm in approaching that, and there's more than 10 fingers can reach out and touch in department administration, and that's a tough task, and your degree of energy, I just say congratulations on your approach to that, and it appears to me that you have the energy, the enthusiasm, and the capability to make that work, and I wish you the best in that.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Other questions from members? Senator Wagner.
I just, not to do with qualification or anything, he said, you talked about the state travel office and the Medicaid saved over $700,000 in 1 year.
1 year.
Where are we sending these Medicaid patients that it takes that much travel and we have enough travel that we save $700,000 a year travel?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, we're sending them wherever Hess tells us to send them. That's point one. But I think there's a lot of traffic, quite honestly, as I understand it, between Bethel and Anchorage and the medical centers in Anchorage. I think there's quite a bit of traffic that goes outside to some of the Seattle area hospitals and that sort of thing. But it's, you know, and we could find out more about that. But the sheer quantity of it is, I think the cost is somewhere around $25 million a year in Medicaid travel and another $25 million in executive branch travel. So, you know, and one thing I didn't get to say was, we only have three and a half or four of the departments in the STO right now, and we had kind of a disincentive to join that was going on, because Alaska Airlines, bless their hearts, said, okay, while you ramp up your STO and you bring in department after department, teach them how to do this in a centralized way, we'll give you a special discount fare for the folks that are outside the department. I think it was 10% or something, an e-cert. And they were supposed to go through June of last year, and then we weren't all in. And it was supposed to, then they said, okay, please give us till the end of the year. And they said, fine, we'll give you the end of the year. And then I went and sort of begged them for like June 30, and they said, well, we think we're enabling you. So now there's an incentive for all the departments to get in, because they're not going to get the discounts. And we've got a calendar, actually, of all the departments being in by June 30. And then we'll see even greater savings. But it's an enormous amount of travel.
And just
the airlines must love us, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I do believe we're their largest customer.
Saw and I think maybe an email, maybe it was a note back from my own staff about whether legislators can avail themselves of that negotiated ticket price. Do you know what?
I do know, Senator. I was requested by Speaker Harris and President Stevens to look into that. Any element of state government is eligible as long as it's state travel, you know, for state business. And it's just a matter of going through the process, just like the Department of Law or any other department, of joining. And that could certainly be done. And you could avail yourself of, for example, these discounted hotel rates that we're negotiating now through U.S. Travel and various hotels in the five major cities where we buy hotel rooms. The state of Alaska buys 100,000 hotel rooms nights a year. And we buy 50,000 in just five cities. And so what we did was we just went and said, okay, let's have U.S. Travel send out a letter, they're our agent, to all these main hotels and say, we really appreciate your government rate, thanks, but how about cheaper? We're not promising anything. And by God, they actually wrote back, and a good bunch of them gave us another 5-10% discount. So that's the kind of low-hanging fruit we're going to try to get, and that could be provided to the legislature as well.
But not until the legislature as a body signs on?
Right. One of the conditions of the contract with Alaska Airlines was, we'll only deal with one point of contact. You want a cheap deal, you've got to have a centralized travel office, because I guess they just want, you know, 10,000 state employees calling them. They got to verify then if it really is state travel. I mean, they needed to have some kind of coordination. That's why we went out, got U.S. Travel as a contractor through an RFP process. As soon as you come in, now that would mean that you'd have to, you know, call the state travel office. U.S. travel agents would book the travel and all of that, and you'd pay a fee. And that's the way we fund U.S. travel doing the work. And our side, that is the admin side of the state travel office, is there's a transaction fee for each ticket. Now, the part of the problem with the economy of this is, when you only have 3.5-4 departments in, you don't have the economy of scale, and the fee seems large compared to the discount you're getting. So we need more. So you're welcome in. You'll help us lower our fees.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Elton.
Yeah, thanks. There's no TV camera here, so I'll tell this to my colleague from the Valley, that if my wife duct taped the checkbook, it would be to hold it closed. She would have had a different purpose. And I'm going to call you commissioner, because I think that's the end result here. I hate to second guess the judgment of my colleagues, but maybe not a lead pipe cinch. I mean, you've done a pejorative here on lead pipes by passing around the cutout. I too appreciate the visits that you made to the offices. I thought it was very helpful to me, and I was especially pleased with the conversation that we had on Public Defender's Office, OPA, and APOC. I appreciate the attention that you have given to those components of your agency, and I think I told you the story about how pleased some of the people were in APOC that they actually had an opportunity to talk to you. It was a different experience for them. So I appreciate that. One of the things that hadn't yet happened when we had the visit, and that has kind of blown up in the news recently, was the situation with the computers in DNR, and one of the concerns that I have had expressed to me in the interim since this has come to the fore was the characterization of one of the people who left DNR as potentially having done something illegal. And in fact, I think the comments that you made to the press was that there was a potential legality problem. We have gotten a letter from the commissioner of DNR dated today that ends by saying that DNR has no complete backup of the information that may have been stored on either of the state laptop computers. And so that's kind of out there. It's something that has now become part of the public discourse of something that I think, as we look back over the long history, the way we've talked about this issue has been very difficult and not necessarily productive. But one of the things that has bothered me, and it bothered me when I read the newspaper story from the Newsminer, was the characterization of the state employee as possibly having done something illegal. So I got in touch with Mr. Van Dyke and the acting director that has replaced Mr. Myers. And here is, I mean, the characterization has been that something illegal happened. Here is Mr. Van Dyke's, his comments that seem to be completely opposite of the characterizations by you and by the commissioner of DNR. He's saying that in response to our questions, and this response came in today, that all emails were preserved, all electronic gas line documents were written to disk and preserved by Mr. Myers, and that the Division of Oil and Gas has a copy of the disk, that all paper copies of gas line documents as well as other director-related documents were preserved by Mr. Myers, and Division of Oil and Gas has them. And then he kind of sums up by saying it would be inappropriate to assign Director Myers' computers to other staff members in the division with the above-mentioned data and information still on them. That is our plan for the computers when we get the computers back from DOA. And that to his knowledge, the appropriate information was preserved. That seems to be in stark contrast to the characterizations that were made earlier by yourself and by and today by the Commissioner of DNR. And I'd like to get your perspective on the apparent schizophrenic reaction from one person versus another person.
Well, through the chair, Senator Elton, I guess I begin with, I don't know where you're getting the impression that we've alleged something illegal happened. I've read the articles, and I don't know which Fairbanks newspaper article in which I was quoted as saying something illegal happened. I've talked about the obligation of state employees to maintain public records. I've talked about the circumstance where we learned of the potential of public records having been destroyed. The reality is we can't know for sure what was destroyed. It's like proving a negative. I mean, if we now know, and we do, that there was a representation made, again, according to the newspaper, the representation was made, I think, I hate to rely just upon that, but I guess if that's where we're starting, in the newspaper a couple of days ago, it says that the fellow at DNR said he told Myers that it was department policy not to erase the hard drives, but if all the information on the computers had been copied, it would be all right to go ahead. I guess that's the premise upon which that story was based, and now we know. And in fact, I knew because we checked in December that there were no backups for those laptops. And so if that's the case, then what we also know is whatever was on those computers has been lost. Now, how you prove what was on those computers, I don't know how you do that. All we know for sure is that some select documents were copied, provided to the Division of Oil and Gas folks, and then the computers were erased. But that's not their normal policy, and certainly if, in fact, a backup had been made so that we could be certain that important documents were not lost. I mean, think about what we're talking about here. We're not talking about just everyday, ordinary state public records of some bureaucrat writing to another. We're talking about documents concerning potentially the most important transaction in Alaska's history. We're also talking about a circumstance where the Department of Law was essentially on the hunt to find the documents necessary to obtain, to create the administrative record for the gas line contract and to respond to Port Authority Public Records Act requests. That being said, you know, we took it very seriously that there were allegations that these documents were lost. We still take it seriously. I wish those computers were available to be restored. I wish the data had been backed up. That's the best of all possible worlds, but we've learned that, and learned some time ago in my case, that that's not the case. And
if
those
I can
are
follow.
The facts.
I think I understand what you're saying, Commissioner. I do want to, and I, of course, would be the last person to say that what I read in any news report may correctly reflect what happened or not. The newspaper story says Acting Commissioner of Administration Scott Nordstrand on January 30th accused Myers of ordering the erasing of data on two laptop computers issued to him by the division, possibly wiping out public records in the process. That stands in stark contrast to the response that we, and that stance seems to be backed up in the letter from the Commissioner of DNR, Mr. Menge. And that seems to stand in stark contrast to what the person kind of in charge of preserving data says. I mean, Mr. Van Dyke says all emails were preserved, gas line related as well as all other on the email server. All electronic gas line documents, and I agree with you that those are some of the most important documents that we could possibly have stored in a paper standing file or in a computer file, that all electronic gas line documents were written to disk and preserved by Mr. Myers, and that Division of Oil and Gas has a copy of the disk. All paper copies of gas line documents as well as other director-related documents. He then says that, you know, ends by saying, to my knowledge, the appropriate information was preserved. That seems to fly in the face of other things, of what you said in the newspaper story. Mr. Myers also suggested that he had talked to the Department of Administration for 40 minutes about this issue a month ago, and thought that he had an understanding that the right things had been done. So it seems that he was somewhat surprised to hear the characterization of what may or may not have happened as having been done illegally.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, you know, the review that we did and the discussions that were had with Mr. Myers, really, in terms of backing something up or preserving something, his comments focused on that CD-ROM that he prepared. His comments did not focus on a tape backup, which seemed to be the focus of what he mentioned in his email from South America yesterday. One thing to keep in mind about this idea of a tape backup, and I urge you to focus on what Commissioner Menge said, a tape backup is a means, truly, of restoring a computer after some disaster happens to its original configuration, and they were doing weekly nighttime tape backups of the computers that were connected to the network and on. The problem is that Director Myers' computers were seldom connected to the network and on at the time that the backups were happening, and so no backup happened. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that both of his computers had been connected, had been on, had been backed up. This method of preservation that he asserts here will be gone in 2 months. It's a 2-month tape cycle, at which time they're overwritten. It is not a reasonable means to preserve extraordinarily important public records. If, by his statements, and again, I it's a newspaper article, I don't know what the email from him said. Let's assume for the sake of argument that it's true. He was relying upon this tape backup to preserve these documents. That's why he told, I presume, allegedly, that Nico Bus should, and you know, it's okay to erase it because I've preserved it. And I think even the newspaper article of yesterday mentioned, and we can say it talks about the tape backup itself as being the vehicle. I assume that the data had been preserved in the division's routine backup of confidential information to tape. Now, we also know, I mean, that's gone in 2 months. So that's not an acceptable method of preserving public records.
Mr. Chair.
Just let me interject. So if that's to prevent or to allow retrieval of data when the machine just goes down.
Right.
That was augmented by the fact that he provided the DV or the CD.
And I would just, Mr. Chair, add to your comments. I mean, we can take Mr. Myers out of this discussion completely. I mean, and I'd like you to focus on the comments by Mr. Van Dyke, the acting director, who essentially said nothing was lost. The data that needed to be preserved was preserved. We can take Mr. Myers and his understanding or misunderstanding of, you know, the data copying stuff and focus. I mean, it just seems to me that what Mr. Van Dyke is saying is that Mr. Myers did everything appropriate and that that to his knowledge the appropriate information was preserved.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I guess I can only tell you what I know, and I've tried to do that the best I can. I can tell you I have no idea how Mr. Van Dyke would know whether or not Mark Myers deleted any of his email, any more than the person that Senator Terrio might know how if you deleted email from your email system. If you look at the second line, all electronic gas line documents were written to disk. Well, I that could very well be true, but I really don't know how anybody but the person who did it would know what was written to disk. And so these are statements, they're assertions, and I understand. I'm not challenging them. I'm not saying they're true or false. I'm just saying that I don't know how you would verify that. I can only talk about what I can verify through our investigation. And I can verify that two laptop computers were erased multiple times with a specialized software designed to prevent data from being recovered, which, if you're going to reformat a computer, that makes sense, I guess. But I have no idea how somebody who isn't Mr. Myers would be able to know these things, and I guess you would have to ask him.
Mr. Chair, I'm done with this line of, I just think it's important. I mean, the way we talk about business and the way we go about business, I mean, it just seems to me that what we have here is a pretty stark contrast from the person, the frontline person charged with protecting documents, documents that need to be protected because of the situation that occurred and the kind of the transition that occurred. But you know, it just seems to me that Mr. Van Dyke, the person who was running the department in the absence of Mr. Myers, if he believes that all emails were preserved, then and they were preserved on the server, then I'm going to assume that that's correct. I mean, it seems to me too quick to assume that something nefarious and potentially illegal happened when the person most at risk was assured that the right things had happened, believes the right things had happened, and yet other people are asserting that something illegal may have happened. And I just find that an unfortunate and situation that doesn't necessarily lead to where we want to go here. I think it would be helpful for me anyway to understand how this data has been used and how it was saved, but the person whose reputation has been questioned and the person who is now doing the job believe they did everything in the right way and that nothing was lost. And there may be no way of finally understanding what the course of events were, but I think it's unfortunate the way we've been talking about it.
Scott, can you tell us in the article yesterday, of course, indicated Mr. Van Dyke was not available for comment. Has there been a decision? Well, there must have been some kind of decision that Mr. Menge would weigh in with the letter that we received this afternoon. And of course, you've been quoted in the paper, but Mr. Van Dyke, who took over from Deputy, or Division Director Myers has not been available for comment. Are we to assume anything from that, or?
I certainly can't.
Okay, okay. And then the other thing is that, let's see, lost my train of thought on that one, but the one comment that that sort of caused me to grind my teeth a little bit, and this is not with regards to Mr. Myers, but you did have a quote in the paper last week that said, "Our concern is that an LBNA consultant was providing potentially confidential information to executive-level employees." Yet everybody that was sort of in the mix was on the inside of the confidentiality circle. So I don't understand the basis for the statement that would suggest that any confidential information was given to anybody that it should not have been.
And I'd be happy to address that. I think this is one of those moments where being a lawyer is not helpful for me, which actually comes by quite often, as you might expect. When I say confidential here, the word I was referring to is confidential attorney-client privilege. I wasn't referring to confidential. There is no question that all those that have signed the confidentiality agreement, your folks and those in the administration, have the right to exchange information about the negotiations and whatever is deemed appropriate to make the thing go forward. What I was talking about here, and perhaps inartfully, was the concept of attorney-client communications, where you're procuring legal advice, and you know, so we're talking about potentially providing, and I would rewrite it if I could, attorney-client, confidential attorney-client information to executive-level employees, where they are not representing those individuals. So I apologize if I was unclear, and but that was my intent.
Okay, and that, I appreciate that clarification, because I guess I took that as, you know, an allegation that LBNA or its consultants have been the source of any leak of information, and to date I can't think of any document that's come out that's been traceable back to LBNA or its consultants or staff or anybody. So I understand what you were trying to get to there, and that clears that up for me. Can you tell me the story yesterday alleged that there was this 40-minute interview with Mr. Myers. Did that, in fact, take place? Was that something that's sort of the normal, a departure interview? Who was part of that interview?
There was, as I indicated in my statement last weekend, I believe it was, when we learned, that is, the Department administration, and I in particular, learned that there had been some allegation that documents may have been erased, we undertook, as the Division of Personnel does, an investigation. Not myself, but people within the division go out and do this on a regular basis, whether, and, you know, it could be all manner of kinds of investigations, you know, from using your computers to download porn to do who knows what. But, you know, employees leave and things go missing and all that kind of thing, and, you know. And so we have people who go out and ask questions and interview people and try to figure out what happened. And as part of that process, Mark Myers was interviewed by this person from the Division of Personnel. So it wasn't an exit interview. It wasn't that kind of thing. This was much later. This would have been, you know, I guess I first learned about this in early December, and then our process began thereafter to try to figure out what happened and why.
Did he detail what, in fact, he copied the disk and how he might have decided what document was needed to be preserved and what didn't? Was that a line of questioning in the interview?
Senator, I don't know. I don't know. I could find out. I could ask the person who did the interview to find out, you know, what kinds of things. I think it's clear that the intent was by Mr. Myers to take relevant gas line documents, you know, on a disk to hand on to successors. I mean, that's clearly what he has said repeatedly. I don't know that there's any way of, and I really don't know if he asked them questions like that, mm-hmm. or if there'd be a reasonable way of defining what kinds of documents you pick. I assume he picked those that he deemed most useful, valuable, and required by the law.
Mm-hmm. So was it one person from the Office of Personnel, or?
Well, there were two people. There was one person from the Division of Personnel that handled the personnel side of this, the talking with employees, seeing what happened kind of side of it. And then there was a person from Enterprise Technology Services, our state security officer, who handled the computer side of this in order to preserving the computers and retrieving them. You know, one of the things that's going to be happening is completely consistent with what the Department of Law was trying to do is these computers will be examined to extract Stranded Gas Act documentation for purposes of the administrative record and for the requests for Public Records Act requests that have come along. I mean, and I don't know if we've talked about this individually, but it's actually kind of fascinating. The Department of Law has hired a law firm that has the capability to do essentially electronic discovery, because in this day and age there are potentially millions of documents that may have to do with this, and they're going department, the Office of the Governor, you know, Revenue, Law, DNR, and what they're doing is they're using a little computer program to identify documents by certain characteristics. And it would be emails or documents or anything that say stranded gas or particular names of people that had been involved in the negotiations. And then it actually comes back with a list of information. Okay, now you can, here's the list of things we found. And ultimately, this software will copy those things separately. So that way, you can sort of extract out the information that you think you should look at for purposes of producing it as a Public Records Act request or an administrative records request. And then, then frankly, it goes to the lawyers, and they have to look at it for privileges, whether it be deliberative process or attorney-client or confidentiality. But so it automates how you get all this stuff together, and that was the process that led us to the Department of Administration's involvement.
I see. Well, at the very least, I've learned a lot about computers and how you have to be very careful with computers. I mean, I am very mindful of any website I go to, any email I send, things of that nature. But just in this modern day and age, that type of electronic ability to go back and find all kinds of things is astounding. Question?
And I've learned that I'm going to have to figure out how to deal with the data on my machine when I either leave my job or am asked to leave my job. So, Mr. Chair, and Scott, Commissioner, you may have answered this question already with your last little comment. I guess I was wondering, when issues like this come up, I guess what I was wondering is why does the Department of Administration, why is that the lead investigatory agency rather than the Department of Law or the Department of Natural Resources?
Chair, Senator Elton. The reason is because the Division of Personnel is charged with investigating employee misconduct. The Department of Law is not charged. Essentially, we're the ones that go in and do, for example, there are allegations of sexual harassment or discrimination or, some violation of personnel rules. They're basically our rules. And so the Division of Personnel enforces them. And so if it's a misappropriation of state property, now, that doesn't mean there couldn't ultimately be, in the right circumstance, a referral to the Department of Law for some kind of criminal prosecution. But that would be an extraordinary circumstance, I think. Basically, once an investigation is complete, then a list of options is presented in terms of what's the reasonable action to take against the employee if there was some wrongdoing found, or nothing if the employee was exonerated. But it is the charge of the Division of Personnel to investigate personnel matters of all kinds for the state of Alaska.
And a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. I mean, is there a process that prompts that kind of a review? I mean, does somebody have to file an allegation? And if so, who do they file it with? Or can this be a process that is kind of just jump-started because somebody heard something about somebody?
Through the Chair, Senator Elton, I think it can be both. I mean, I guess in my background in employment law, I'm somewhat familiar with this too, and having been in the Civil Division advising the Division of Personnel and occasionally through our other lawyers, it can be a formal complaint. I mean, there are forms you can fill out. It could, but It could be that, you know, a personnel, some supervisor hears something and is concerned about it, thinks there may be some inappropriate pressure being put on an employee or some kind of an inappropriate relationship that is causing an employee problems, and then they report it to their supervisor, and ultimately they call the Division of Personnel's folks that, you know, advise each department. You may have heard about the HR consolidation. Some people didn't like it, but the departments now go to the Division of Personnel for their advice, and they have their person there that, you know, they got a problem, you know, this, say they've got a hiring situation where they don't know what to do, or they've got an allegation of sexual harassment or something like that. They call the Division of Personnel for advice, and there's lots of options, but it's really the responsibility of the division along with the departments to be vigilant for concerns that may not come to that formal kind of level too. So it can be all kinds of things.
If I could just sum up the answer. So you're saying that it's not necessary that somebody file a formal complaint, that an investigation can be prompted on something far less formal than that, just a rumor or, you know, a suspicion or something else, and that can lead to the kind of circumstance that we had here where somebody reviews what's maybe remaining or what may have been erased from computers.
I wouldn't want to say that, you know, a mere rumor is, you know, necessarily appropriate to begin some kind of a formal investigation, but I think, I mean, in the legal business, we might say you're on inquiry notice, that if someone is saying something bad is happening to a state employee, or that a state employee might be doing something, absconding with state property or something like that, we have a responsibility to do a commensurate level of investigation to the allegation that's given, and I'm sure it would ratchet up as it went. You know, you get the odd phone call from an employee and says, I think so-and-so is doing this. You send someone out to ask a question or two of that person, and if it seems credible, you might go further. But I don't think there's really a one-size-fits-all approach to personnel matters.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wagner?
Just all this discussion about computers and emails brought up kind of an interesting question I'd like to ask, and it really doesn't have anything to do with any of this. What capabilities does the Department of Administration have to review emails written by the legislators or the legislative staff in this building?
None, as far as I know. You folks have your own system. We, as I understand it, and I'm a little bit technical, but I think this question was asked, and I went and found out that, in fact, we don't have any capability in the executive branch to see your computers or your emails, all of that. But I think ultimately your traffic goes across the state network. It connects up, but that's all I know.
Senator Wagner, that might be something that we perhaps would, because I've had a number of legislators, because all of this has made people more sensitive to access to electronic documents, ask me about it, and we might want to have somebody from our own DP office come over and give us some information. I know that last year there was an assertion that the Department of Administration had sensed inappropriate websites being accessed by somebody on the legislative side of the firewall. They could tell it was being accessed. They couldn't tell who, and so they got in touch with our people to track that down, so the problem could be addressed on the legislative side. So there's some ability to see what's going on. I'm not sure that it goes to the level of reviewing individual documents that are being sent. But certainly, if you've got the little electronic bugs that you can send out on a search through everybody's electronic file cabinet, you know.
No, we don't have them.
We'd like to know if those bugs have the ability to be sent into our building.
We're going to exterminate
bugs.
Yeah.
Hey, do we have any other questions? Okay. Well, I think that certainly, you know, this latest issue has been very interesting and somewhat troubling from time to time, but it shouldn't overshadow necessarily the work the commissioner has done on trying to you know, energize the people in his department to do a good job on the state's behalf with the way they operate their business. So at this point, I guess if there are any other questions for the commissioner? No? And then that's the only other thing that we have on the agenda for today. And
please take your blunt object with us.
It's not well
to leave it with the legislature.
And Commissioner, can we perhaps get just a little bit more information on the interview that was done, since that was mentioned in the press in particular? And I think that people are going to want to know whether in that exchange, whether assurances were given on the documents that were saved, or the types of documents that were saved. Because I'm sure, and perhaps we will eventually get to a point where we will be able to say, let's see a printout of all those documents, but I certainly expect at this point they are covered in the confidentiality and can't be all disclosed at this point, but perhaps at some point they might be. So with that, no further questions, that brings us to close of the hearing today.
Thank you.